Well, hey there, freaks. It's your boy Marty here to introduce this week's sponsor. You already know all about them, the Cash App, helping us stack sats. The Cash App has been the number one finance app in the app stores for the last 2 years, and it's the first P2P payments app to let you freaks buy Bitcoin. You can stack sats via the app pretty easily. It's my favorite way to do it these days. And then when you're ready to take custody into your own hands and you're comfortable of custodying your UTXOs, you can easily send it to your Ledger, your Trezor, your Electrum wallet, whatever the wallet of your choice is, and take your monetary sovereignty into your own hands. On top of this, they have the Incredible Boost program, which comes with a personalized debit card. You can write your signature, you can write Bitcoin, you can do whatever you want with that. But once you have that debit card, you can use the Boost program. You turn on your Boost, whether it be for Whole Foods, Chick-fil-A, Chipotle, your local coffee shop, and save some money. And then maybe if you save that money, maybe you automatically convert that into sats. Maybe one day they'll have sats back. Maybe. I don't know. So go to the App Store, whether it's Google Play or the Apple App Store, and download Cash App today. Hope you freaks enjoy this interview with Andrew Torba. I know I certainly did. A very interesting man fighting a very, very admirable fight in my mind. Hope you freaks enjoy. Tales from the Crypt. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent in some random hotel in the Fashion District of Manhattan, New York. A very foreign studio. This interview came together, I believe, 12 hours ago. Maybe, probably like 16 hours ago. I'd like to introduce you freaks to the founder, CEO of Gab.com, Andrew Torba.
How's it going, everybody?
Thanks for joining.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming out here. It's a last minute thing, but I'm glad that we could get this done.
I'm pumped to get this done because you are a man who's drawn the ire of a lot of online haters because of what you're doing with Gab. So let's just jump right into it. This is Tales from the Crypt. Our tale is usually about how you came to find Bitcoin, but I'm more interested about why you came to found Gab, and we'll get to Bitcoin later. So
yeah, I could talk about that as well.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We've got plenty of time. So
sure.
Gab, what is the reasons behind starting it, and what sort of sent you down this path?
Sure. So my last company was in ad tech, and we were working very closely with Facebook, with Twitter, with Google on their ads APIs. So I have a lot of friends inside of Facebook, Twitter, and Google. And, you know, in the run-up to the 2016 election, I was very active on the Donald subreddit. I was very active on Twitter. I had a lot of sock accounts and stuff because I had to, you know, keep my politics to myself. And that was true when I was in Silicon Valley as well. So, you know, as a Christian, as a conservative Republican, it's something that you tend to self-censor about, especially if you're in Silicon Valley or really any major city, which is sad, but it was the reality at the time. And up to the 2016 election, I started to see a lot of this censorship start to happen. Some weird stuff happening on the Donald where, you know, things weren't appearing on the top page that were trending and were breaking news, and random stuff being pulled down, and the CEO going in and editing stuff about himself, and just shady stuff.
Alexis,
right?
O'Hanlon?
Huh?
Alexis O'Hanlon?
No, it was Spez.
Okay.
Yeah, so just weird stuff. And then obviously the manipulation of trends on Twitter and you know, people like Milo getting banned and stuff like that. Like that had never happened. So Silicon Valley had always, you know, touted free speech and individual liberty and American values for the past decade. And all of a sudden they just did this about face, you know, during the rise of Brexit and during the rise of Donald Trump and this populist movement that's happening really all around the world. And I said, you know, we can sit here and whine about this, or we can build a solution. And I said, I'm going to build a solution. I don't see anybody else building. We have this illusion of choice where we have, you know, the top 20 apps in the App Store are really owned by like three companies. You know, consumers don't know that Facebook owns Instagram. They own WhatsApp. They own all of it, right? So you think that you're using different apps, but you're not. You're using apps that are owned all by the same company. I said, well, I'm just going to found my own. And, you know, free market, right? You don't like it, go build your own is the saying. And that's exactly what I did. And I would learn that the market isn't so free very quickly.
Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, with mobile app distribution, Apple and Google own 98% of mobile app distribution. So that's not a free market. That's a duopoly. And they refused to allow us into the App Store, even though we're compliant with their App Store guidelines. We went out of our way to become compliant with their App Store guidelines, probably even more so than some of the apps that exist today. And they still won't let us on. And they have direct partnerships with Twitter, with obviously Google has YouTube. So, you know, we're kind of competing with some of their partners and some of their core products. So I see that as them abusing their market power to stifle competition, which, you know, antitrust, where you at?
So do you have to use like F-Droid to...
We were sideloading for a while, but we started focusing a lot of our product initiative on mobile web and doing things like a lot of people don't know you can add a Safari bookmark to your iOS home screen. And it will open up, and it looks and feels and operates like a native app. The only thing you don't get is push notifications. So we've been focusing on that, and it's actually worked really well. And it's incredible that we've gone to now almost a million members without any apps on the App Store as a social network in 2019. It's just wild, but it is what it is. It shows the demand that's there.
It does. And I've got a couple questions based off of that, line of thinking right there. So one, obviously a lot. These social networks, these companies, these entrenched Silicon Valley companies have huge market share, huge mind share, and sort of an entrenched Lindy effect, if you will. We're talking Bitcoin, Lindy effect comes up.
Sure.
What is it like? How's it been trying to get people to use Gab and switch? Because there is switching costs, mental costs, stuff like that. Like myself, like I have a Gab account, but I don't go on it too often, to be honest. Like,
yeah, I think, you know, from day one, we've welcomed everybody, right? I didn't want Gab to be a conservative only, or first of all, technology does not have a political ideology. Technology is politically agnostic. But, you know, inevitably, we started getting people who were banned from other sites. And increasingly, as more and more people are being banned, we're starting to see our community shift from center right into more of a centrist and center left, because now it's not only people on the quote unquote far right that are being banned, but it's you know, centrists and people that are in the center left, or even people that are apolitical that just happen to post a wrong thing on the internet. So I think that as this starts to accelerate, people are starting to wake up, and some of their favorite content creators can't be found anywhere else but on Gab. So they're signing up and they're following them and they're starting to post. And I think that really for us, the next step is about access technology. And that's what the browser's about is, you know, we fundamentally have to build our own access technology. Like at first I just wanted to build a social network, but it turns out now I have to build payments infrastructure. I have to build hosting. I have to find a new DNS, all of it. So that's the next step for me is providing the access technology as a top of the funnel driver to back to Gab. And I think that's working phenomenally so far with the browser, and it's only in alpha. I don't say beta, I say alpha.
And again, there's so many, we're going to get down all these paths. So the first path is, why do you think these institutions are censoring so hard? Like a big theme on this podcast is that we've been born into this inflection point predicate around the internet. Things are changing at a pace at which they've never changed in human history.
Right.
And to me, it seems like it's just entrenched power, hierarchical power, trying to cling on to the power that they do have.
That's exactly what it's about. Is you know, all these companies are based in one central location. You want to talk about centralization? I don't think that there's anything more centralized than the technology industry is today. And I think that's rapidly changing. You know, we have developers from all over the world who are helping us with Gab. And I think that is the future forward, where you don't have to be in this centralized location. There are people all around the world who, you know, share the values that we share, you know, free speech for everybody, privacy rights, you know, the ability to access information. And this censorship, it's all about control. You nailed it. It's just they're losing their power. They're losing their power to influence and to control narratives. And, you know, somebody could be out in the street and be at an event that is happening right now and give you the truth, versus, you know, seeing the quote unquote framed truth on CNN and if they want to spin it or whatever. So they don't have that power anymore to control the narrative around situations or around political movements or any of that. And that scares them because it's a threat to their power. So that's why we're seeing this.
Yeah. And it's, it seems like it's getting to a point where it's, and I think this is why you're, Gab exists and Dissenter exists now, where we have to fight back and fight for our rights, which is at a time. I wrote an article in a daily newsletter that I write yesterday about Brad Sherman coming out against Bitcoin. And right. it's like, if we want this stuff, we have to fight it. We have to build yes. it. And there's the crux of my argument is like, there's been an entropy in America around freedom since the Declaration of Independence was signed. And we've gotten so far away from that I don't think the system is able to be saved from within. So,
well, I think we take it for granted too. You know, try being a Christian in China, try being gay in any Middle Eastern country, right? You know, we could openly talk about these things. We can be who we want to be here, but unless we defend our fundamental civil liberties and human rights to be able to talk about stuff, first and foremost, that's priority number one, because when you lose your ability to talk about things, there's no way to fight back. You can't, you know, when they come for your speeches first, and then they're going to come for your guns, and then they're going to come for your privacy. So it's just, it's an escalation effect. And I don't want to see that happen. I don't want to grow up. I don't want my kids to grow up on an internet where it's controlled by like two or three companies who, you know, decide what we can talk about and what we can't, and what information we can access and can't, and what is news and what isn't. That's not a world that I want to live in. And that's why I'm building. I think, you know, there's a lot of people now, this issue, when I first started talking about this back in 2016 and, you know, kind of raising the alarm, like, hello, this is happening. What are we doing? This is insane. We have American citizens who are being silenced on the internet by corporations that have a monopoly, a duopoly on information, on every vertical in technology and infrastructure. This is madness. Like, why is no one talking about this? And now we're getting to the point where the president of the United States is tweeting about this issue. This is a major campaign issue for 2020 for both the left and the right, talking about big tech, talking about the censorship, which is great, but we can't just talk about it. We have to build. Nobody else is building, right? And people rag on Gab a lot, and criticism is fine and whatever, but you know, at least we're building, right? Like, I don't see anybody else stepping up to the plate and building something, building real solutions. Everybody likes to just whine about problems and not actually build a solution to them. And that's what I'm focused on.
Well, that's why I think Bitcoiners in particular are drawn towards Gab or sort of rooting for Gab, is because we find ourselves in a similar situation.
Right.
We're trying to build the financial side of it.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, you look at the start of Bitcoin, and you know, you look at the Silk Road, and Bitcoin got smeared a lot too. Oh, it's only used by criminals, and it's the same thing that happened to Gab, right? Oh, it's only used by the far right, and you know, slowly it's becoming more about, it's for everybody, and it's about freedom, and it's about individual sovereignty, and all of these things that we take for granted as Americans. That I want to outsource American privacy to people around the world. I want to outsource First Amendment protections that we have as an American company to people around the world who don't have those things. I think, you know, the Silicon Valley is very, very hypocritical. You see the Arab Spring, for example, where it was literally called the Twitter Revolution. And free speech is great when it's powering an Arab revolution. But now we're seeing a populist revolution happen you know, in the West, and now it's not okay suddenly, and now we have to start cracking down and banning people and shadow banning and demonetizing people that are pushing fundamental liberties. To be honest, they're not even pushing like violence or anything illegal per se. They're just pushing a different political opinion that the people in power happen to disagree with.
Yeah, and it's so you spent some time in the belly of the beast. I think not yes. too many people know, but you spent some time at Y Combinator.
Yes, yeah. My last company, we were a Y Combinator company. And for those of you who don't know, Y Combinator is basically like the Harvard of tech accelerators. So I was in the inner circle of inner circles. I was in the belly of the beast. I spent a lot of time at all of these companies, you know, working with people in these companies. So I know how they think. I know what their agenda is. I know how they act. And, you know, it's great to be out of that belly. When I found a Gab, I was like, okay, I got to get out of San Francisco now, right?
One in particular, of their mindset sort of perturbed you.
The groupthink, to be honest, it's like it's a little bubble, and they think that their way of thinking is the only way to think, and their political ideology is the only political ideology that is has merit. And the moral superiority is really what gets me. You know, a lot of them obviously went to Ivy League schools and stuff, and they think that because they had that privilege, that they are superior in morality and in wisdom, that they should be the benevolent dictators over the entire internet and over what is news and what information we're allowed to access, what we're allowed to talk about, what links we're allowed to share. And I think that's fundamentally wrong, and it's not what the internet has been for decades, and it has slowly become more and more centralized, which I think is bad. Not only centralized in the technical sense, but centralized in just location too. It's like all of these major companies are all in one city. Like, that's a problem. You have technology that's used by billions of people, and it's controlled by a handful of them that all share the same political ideology, the same beliefs. They think the same way, and they shun anybody who doesn't think like them. And we're seeing that manifest itself with these bands and stuff now.
Revenge of the Nerds, not as funny as we thought it was going to be. So let's jump into your college major. You double majored in philosophy and political science, correct?
Right. I ended up dropping the poli sci because I was starting a business and doing a double major, being in the honors program. I dropped the honors program too. And then I had a minor in entrepreneurship. So I just stuck with the philosophy, which a lot of people balk at and say, well, what are you going to do with that? Well, I use it every day. Writing, critical thinking, being able to speak clearly and concisely, all of those things I use every single day. And just being able to study some of the greatest thinkers in history, it was really pivotal and influential on my thinking and my approach to life.
I was an econ major, but I spent every elective I could on philosophy classes, and it's
it's addicting once you get into it.
It is, and been reading more philosophy books like after college and diving into it, and Stoics in particular.
Stoicism is really coming back. Yeah. It's kind of like the hip new.
It's really
way
simple
of thinking now. Yeah.
It's really simple. Just be a good person is basically.
Yeah.
So what thinkers in particular sort of form your?
Oh,
your
I think. I think the classic Socrates is the perfect example of someone who was censored for wrong think, not only censored but killed.
Starved to death, right? Or poisoned?
He had to
starve then poisoned.
He had to kill himself with the poison. Yeah. But yeah, it's and by the way, he could have escaped as well, but he didn't. He chose to take the punishment because if he was going to stand up for justice, why would he be hypocritical and run from justice. The people had spoken, whether it was right or wrong. Obviously it was wrong. But I think, we see a lot of similarities in what he went through today. He was a wrong thinker, right? he was literally put to death for wrong think. We see a lot of people facing similar trials today. Thankfully they're not being put to death yet, but in some countries that actually does happen. And again, we take that for granted here.
We take it for granted, and it's scary because this stuff's a slippery slope. Like, we're seeing it slowly in United Kingdom with hate speech. Like, yes. What the fuck is hate speech?
I don't know. The Supreme Court says that it is free speech, and unanimously, by the way. You have a divided court on pretty much every major social issue, any issue that comes up, it's a divided court, right, left and right. But they were unanimous on this one, which was, hate speech is free speech. Whatever hate speech is, it's free speech. And this term hate speech, it didn't even exist 100 years ago. You go back 100 years and say, well, why are you saying hate speech? They're going to be like, what? Like, what is that? It's like this absurd concept. Now, are there hateful people in the world? Sure. Is there hateful rhetoric? Sure. But who am I to decide what that is? I'm not a judge. I'm not a jury. I'm not the executioner. I don't want to be. I want people to decide for themselves if they think that something is hateful, then they can choose to not consume that content, not follow that person, block that person, right? You have individual liberty. Freedom of association goes with freedom of expression.
That's I feel like the concept of freedom of association has gone way over the head of much of the public. Like, you do not have to listen to this stuff. You
exactly.
do not have to read this stuff. You can ignore people.
Change the channel.
Right?
Like, turn off the TV,
So, I get offended by CNN and MSNBC whenever I happen to be in an airport at my in-laws and it comes on TV. And I'm just
You can't turn it off there, right?
Right?
You could just kind of look away or put in your headphones, but... Yeah, I think the freedom of association thing, people tend to neglect. We in particular, and obviously a lot of the other social networks, give people the tools to shape their own experience, and that's how it should be. If you don't want to see something, block it. If you can even get down to muting individual words on Gab and now on Twitter. If you don't want to see certain words, you can mute those, and then you never see them. So, what's the problem, right? Like, if other people want to see edgy content or... You know, that's the other thing too, is I'm a big fan of comedy, right? And I think you can measure the health of free expression in a society by what comedians are allowed to get away with and by who the popular comedians are. And, you know, you look at the popular comedians now and it's like Amy Schumer talking about her bowel movements. And I don't find that funny. First of all, I don't understand how she's a mainstream comedian. And most of my, most of my favorite comedians are not mainstream comedians. They're, you know, they're anonymous accounts on Gab or on Twitter. You know,
like, Titiana McGrath.
Right. Yeah. Parody accounts, which are now, by the way, getting banned.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Like overt parody.
Oh, literally says parody in the headline. Yeah. Mm. Crazy. But it is what it is.
It is what it is, but it's scary because, and again, this is another topic we talk a lot about, and this is touching on what we mentioned earlier, like you have to build your way out of this, fight for it. Like you have a path right now. You could choose to become dystopian China or your facial recognition or jaywalking, or we can build these systems that sort of let us hold our sovereignty and our individualism. That's a good topic to jump into now. Like, it seems like the concept of individualism, of extreme ownership over yourself and your being and your house is something that's been led astray. It's dying.
It's very sad. Individual sovereignty, the belief in the individual is a fundamental cornerstone of American society and of Western culture.
And civilized society, I would say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really sad that, you know, if you happen to belong to a certain race or you happen to have a certain sexuality, you're now grouped in with everybody that shares that. And if you don't, you know, have the politics of XYZ group or XYZ race, you're a traitor and you're ostracized.
Yeah, the Venn diagram of what you have to agree with to be on the far left is getting wider and wider. You have to
the Rainbow Coalition is consuming itself. Yes.
You have to be okay with letting 6-year-olds transition now.
It's beyond.
It's sick.
It's getting into our schools. It's getting into our culture, and it's something that you're not allowed to speak up about either. And if you do, you're fired. Or
I felt compelled to speak up about it for some reason. CNBC has been retweeting a tweet of the drag kid, who was at the gay pride parade and was like basically dancing for older men, getting money thrown at him.
Now, if that was a young girl,
exactly.
Right. If that was like a 10-year-old girl,
I had this conversation with my wife, where she was like, "Oh, it's not that bad. Like, what are you? He's just being himself." And I was like, "Imagine if we had a daughter and she was doing that."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And no, I'm about to have a daughter.
It was immediately like, "Oh, yeah, that's not
horrify
right.
Horrify me." Yep.
Right. But for some reason, like they're trying to normal. It seems. Mm-hmm. Not.
Yeah. Don't. They're going after the kids. That's the problem. And they're going after them in a lot of ways. And that's why they're doing a lot of this censorship, too, is because they know that the kids are on social media. You know, they're not sitting in front of the TV. I haven't had a cable subscription in 6+ years. A lot of millennials don't have cable subscriptions, so they can't influence us in the normal channels. And they have to crack down now because the kids are sitting on YouTube all day watching, you know, these content creators who are calling out this stuff as absurd, because it is. And they can't allow that to happen because it messes with their agenda. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, the normalization of hate speech, of things like being okay with letting little kids transition and stuff like that. It seems like, again, like, if you don't agree with the whole party line, like, you get labeled as a zealot, basically.
Well, it's happening to the left, too. I mean, you see feminists now who, I think they call them TERFs, where if they don't want trans women, being involved in feminism, they see it as kind of a takeover, like a hostile takeover type deal, from what I understand. They're ostracized, right? And we've seen those type of feminists banned, which is, it's crazy, because censorship inevitably comes for everybody who steps outside the party line. And it's now starting to hit people on the left as well.
No, another.
Which, by the way, they're welcome on Gab too. Everybody is. We don't ask for your political ideology at sign up.
And you're welcome on Tales from the Crypt too. But it's like feminism in particular too. Like the hijabs also like becoming sort of the alienation of, are you feminist or not? Like you have Iranian women taking off their hijabs and in protest, and then quote unquote feminist here in the States thinking it's a sign of
of
modesty.
Women's power. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Women's power. So it's. I don't know. I'm worried about the future. I'm happy that you're building things.
Someone has to.
What?
Someone has to,
right?
Do it, you know.
But let's dive into, like, are you a neo-Nazi trying to take over the world?
No, I'm absolutely no. I'm a I'm a classical liberal, if anything. Liberal in the old sense, you know, individual liberty for everybody. You know, by the way, including communists, including Nazis. I fundamentally believe that the best way to fight back against hateful ideology, hateful speech, is with more speech, right? Like,
with logic,
right? With more, if these people are not exposed to other ideas or to counter arguments, this stuff is just going to fester and build. And by the way, if people can't express themselves with words on the internet, what's their next move? Violence in the real world, and we're starting to see this manifest. And that's not a world that I want to live in. That's why I fight so hard, is because if you keep silencing these people, you know, they're going to go to the streets. They're going to get violent, and let them post whatever the heck they want. As long as it's legal, as long as they're not themselves, you know, making threats or doxing people, you know, common sense stuff, right? Like, follow the law. But then what's the harm, right? Like, you know, if they're not exposed to other ideas, then that stuff is just going to fester and build and build and build, and they're going to express it in other ways and take it to the real world.
So I'm not trying to dive into any conspiracy theories, but, like, do you think it is a conscious effort by these entrenched social media companies and search engines that are sort of imbuing their views on their users, or do you think it's a mandate from the government, like, hey, we can't have this happen, we need your help here?
Well, like the deep state or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's a lot more common sense than that. I think it's the advertisers are putting pressure on them and saying, like, we don't want to advertise on these wrong think channels because it's going to cause controversy for us. I think it's just all about the money, fundamentally, is they're getting pushback from their advertisers, who are, you know, that's who they answer to. And also their shareholders too. You look at Twitter, which is, you know, they got a nice chunk of ownership by a Saudi prince. 80% of their user base is international. So they have foreign governments who are saying, like, if you want to still operate here, you better do this. And in our case, you know, we don't have that. We're only based in the US. We're a US company, so we have US privacy laws. We have the First Amendment. We regularly turn down data requests and censorship requests from foreign governments all the time. I think that's part of our value add, is if you're somebody who's in the UK and you want to speak freely on the internet without having the government come and knock down your door and arrest you, then you could do so on Gab, you know, as long as you're not threatening any violence or anything crazy, right? If you're just expressing your political opinion that happens to be politically incorrect or happens to be something that the government doesn't like criticizing the migrant crisis, for example, you can do so on Gab without worrying about your data being handed over to the feds and then them knocking on your door and throwing you in jail, which, by the way, is happening. It's happening in the UK. Like, it's crazy.
It's happening at an increasing pace.
Yes.
Like, comments on Facebook are sending people to jail.
Correct. Yes.
This is insanity.
And it's not like the comments are like them threatening to kill somebody or anything like that. It's just like their political opinion. It's crazy.
I think I saw one dude get a knock on the door from the British cops because he said, like, he didn't agree with the immigrant policy. That's
right.
Basically all he said.
That's all he said. Yeah. Saw that. It's crazy.
Right? That's insane. And so another crux of the problem here is that these companies have the ability to sort of instill these policies on their users.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah.
Bitcoin is sort of, in my mind, the first emergence of something where it's like, holy shit, this is totally, one entity or central authority can influence this network.
Right.
And actually, I know we're talking a lot of shit on Twitter and these companies. I interviewed Jack Dorsey a few months ago, and speaking with him, you could even see it in his eyes when we were talking about, like, the early days of Twitter. It seems like he had, like, a nostalgic sort of
I'm sure he does.
Memory of it. He described it as, like, a protocol in the early days, and he misses that feel where it's almost like he didn't have control.
He doesn't have control. You know, he's not a majority shareholder. Zuckerberg is. You know, he still has 60% voting rights and stuff, so there's really no excuse for him. But Jack is not in a position of power. You know, he may be CEO by title, but he doesn't have the power that, you know, somebody with majority voting share like myself or like Mark Zuckerberg does. And it's really sad because you can see in his eyes, you can see in some of the interviews that he's doing that he doesn't like this stuff. I don't think he agrees with a lot of the censorship. you know, Twitter used to call themselves the free speech wing of the free speech party. And, you know, they stood 100% by the First Amendment principles and all this stuff. And, you know, as they started scaling and after they went public and, you know, now they have to appease advertisers, they have to appease the Saudi shareholder that they have, et cetera. They have to appease the foreign governments because the majority of their user base is international, as I mentioned. So I think, you know, his hands are kind of tied in a lot of situations, which I think is why he's excited about Bitcoin, because it kind of gives him like a second chance to express himself through these values that I think he does share. I really do. I think he actually does believe in freedom of speech for everybody. You see the interview with Joe Rogan where, you know, they were talking about shining a light on the negative stuff to cleanse it and whatever, which is my exact argument, you know, more speech versus the censorship and trying to push it into the shadows. So I empathize with Jack because, you know, as a public face of a social network, I can empathize with him. You deal with a lot of stuff and a lot of stuff that you can't talk about and a lot of stuff that happens behind the scenes and a lot of stuff that involves your family. You know, I've been doxxed and swatted and plenty of death threats and stuff like that that you just most people don't know about. But it's a cross that I carry to defend, you know, the civil liberties and the fundamental human rights that I believe everybody should have on the Internet.
You've been swatted?
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Well, my parents were actually.
Fuck.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. Yeah, I got a call from my mom. She said the FBI's here, and someone put an ISIS bomb threat on their house. They had to close down the local elementary school, and it wasn't fun. You know, that's the thing I hate too, is that you come after me, fine. Criticize me, fine. You want to, you know, sling stuff at me, fine. Leave my family out of it. You know, that's not cool. You know, but. They're tough too. And I've had their full support from day one, and very blessed to have nothing horrific happen. A lot of scares, but you know, thankfully we're protected and everything's been all right.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. It's shit scary. It's really scary.
Yep.
Asshole can just call up the FBI and send them to your house.
Yep.
Without any cause or reason.
Well, they actually sent it to the local news stations, yeah. It was not fun.
They sent it to the news station.
Yeah, they sent the threat to the news station, and the address was my parents' house.
So. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, not fun at all. It's the reality of the situation, and I'm sure Jack deals with this stuff every day, too. So I can empathize with him on that. And again, he just doesn't have the control. And speaking of protocols, like I did listen to your interview with him, and I think you're right. Early days of Twitter, it was like a protocol when their API was very open and stuff. But of course they had to kind of stop that because they wanted the eyeballs in their app and not in these third party apps where, you know, they could sell the ads to them and stuff. We don't have to worry about that, thankfully. But where we're moving now is towards more of a protocol as well. So we're moving Gab basically to full open source. You know, we obviously have the browser, which is the fork of Brave, which is ours, is fully open source. We have Bitcoin, which is fully open source, which we're going to be building on. The Dissenter extension itself is fully open source. And now we're in the process of moving Gab to an existing open source protocol. And our fork of it will be totally open source as well. So it's going
to
be exciting.
Yeah, you were describing this business model to me before we hit record. It's forking open source software.
Yes.
Building on that. So what made you come to this realization that this is sort of the best way to leverage these open source softwares?
Well, it's about working smart and not hard, right? And it's about maximizing what you can do with limited resources. So if we have a team of five now and we fork a bunch of open source projects that are being worked on by hundreds of engineers and maintained and we can continue to just, you know, maintain that stuff and pull it down into our forks, I think that's a pretty smart business move. It's a pretty smart move for making Gab even more anti-fragile. So, you know, for example, we open source all of our stuff. And if something happens to me, if something happens to Gab as a company, Gab as an idea lives on. And, you know, people from around the world can keep building on it and hopefully sticking to our principles. So that's the idea, is just make it more anti-fragile and outsource a lot of the development and being nimble and thinking outside the box too, because I mean, you'll never see Twitter open source their whole code base. You'll never see Facebook do this, and that's why we're doing it. Is we want help from developers around the world who share our values, who maybe they can't use their real identity to either join the company or to express support for the company publicly, but they can express it in code anonymously through GitHub or wherever.
Yeah, I think you're exploring a model which may work better than the first iteration of the internet. So that's another topic that we talk a lot on Tales from the Crypt, is maybe in the first go around with the internet, the way we built it was probably not the best ideal way, and
right.
not leveraging open source software mm-hmm. as much as it should be leveraged. And it seems like people are starting to wake up, like, all right, this is probably where the signal is over here.
Yep.
And these tools building on this type of framework.
Well, open source has a lot of benefits, right? I just touched on some of them. Like, you know, you have this army of people around the world that are contributing to these projects and helping us, by the way, whether they like it or not, you know, it's like, and, you know, we've seen some pushback. We've been called parasites for forking open source software, which is kind of bizarre to me, because that's the...
Who's called you a parasite?
Brendan Eich from Brave has called us parasites.
You should not worry about what shitcoiners think of you.
Oh, I don't. I don't at all. Yeah, I think it's just a big tell, you know. It's a tell when you have the co-founder of JavaScript and the co-founder of Mozilla and the CEO of a company that raised $42 million and has a shitcoin that has a $500 million market cap sitting on Twitter all day coming after an upstart that happened to fork their open source software and calling us parasites. And my mentions are just filled with Brave engineers and with Brave CEO all day long. And I just laugh because it means we're a threat.
You put the code out there. What did they expect?
Exactly. That's how open source projects tend to work. You know, you figure if you're in software engineering for 20 plus years, you would understand that, but it is what it is.
And you've had other leaders of projects come at you as well, particularly Ethereum. Didn't Vitalik and Vijay double team you a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
Was that a year ago?
Yeah, that was another saga. I tend to really piss off shitcoiners for some reason. I know. It's... But, you know, it's something that, like, with Brave, for example, like, when Brave first launched, like, I was a huge fan. I was like, this is awesome. Like, they're gonna block ads, they're gonna block trackers, they have Bitcoin integrated, like, I'm all in. And then all of a sudden, like, this ICO came out of nowhere, and this, like, model around advertising, and I'm just like, ugh, like, what happened here? So, you know, there's a reason that we forked Brave, because I'm a big fan of Brave Browser. I am not a fan of Bat. And you know, it's just a fundamental disagreement on business model. They want to sell user data to advertisers. And, you know, of course their pushback is, well, the data is stored locally and it's anonymous and da, da, da. It doesn't matter. That's still your business model. And like, you know, I can fill out online surveys and make, you know, a couple bucks a day versus if you do the math of getting 5 ads an hour on Brave and getting paid in BAT, which you can't cash out. You're going to get like, what, 40 cents a day or something? It's the incentive. And they're like, oh, the user gets the lion's share of the ad revenue. And it's like, okay, it's like 40 cents, dude. Like, sorry, I don't want to see ads for 40 cents. I don't want to see ads for $5. You know, like, it's just, it's a fundamentally flawed model. And I think advertising has ruined a lot of the internet. And people take for granted, they think that advertising is the only business model on the internet, and it's absolutely not. And I think that's where things like Lightning Network and Bitcoin come into play, of cutting out that middleman of the advertiser and creating this peer-to-peer exchange of value between audience and content creator. And that's where we're going.
Yeah, it's something we're experimenting with here at TFTC too. We just put up a website and using BTC Pay server to see if we can get a user contributor model to wean off some ads, and we'll see how it goes. But it's possible now with Bitcoin. I hooked it up to BTC Pay server, hooked that up to a Trezor, and if people decide to contribute, it's right in my hands, my possession.
We're on BTC Pay server as well, because we've been banned from Coinbase, we've been banned from BitPay, we've been banned from Square's Cash App. Not only the company accounts, but also my personal accounts, which is telling. So it's guilt by association of association, right? It's
yeah, this episode was brought to you by Cash App too, so
that's fine. Hey, make your money, man. That's fine.
No, it's
no problems.
No, it's believe it, isn't it? I think we are philosophically and mentally aligned a lot of, and but it is something like, as somebody who's trying to monetize on the web, it's not easy
outside
of advertising.
Absolutely. No, I agree. And I think that if the fundamental problem that Bitcoin has right now is ease of use and user experience. You know, people should be able to just input their debit card and top up and get Bitcoin. You know, this model already exists, right? If you look at mobile games, people will buy credits in mobile games and then use those credits in the game to buy in-game items or whatever. Like, I think the Bitcoin industry, especially developers, need to look at the gaming industry and how this is done and mimic it. Because it, most of the people aren't going to, like, normal people, like, you say sound money to them. And, like, what does that mean? Like, can I hear the money? Like, literally, like, that, like, I don't know what that means as a normal person, right? But you tell them that Bitcoin is free speech money. And, you know, they get it, right? They're like, oh, like, you know, you can send money to anybody in the world and you don't need the permission of a bank or a government or any entity to do so. That's interesting. And I get it, you know? So I think Bitcoin has a little bit of a branding problem. So we, you know, we should rebrand it as free speech money, in my opinion.
Now, thank you for signal boosting that meme. Did you start it?
I don't want to say I started it. I think I helped propel it a little bit.
I wrote about it after you
tweeted it. Yeah, I remember
it.
In your newsletter, I think I saw that.
No, it is. That is something like the first decade in. Unfortunately, we had people marketing Bitcoin as basically free, fast, and free, fast, and it, like, able to buy coffee like at the protocol level, right. which was we're finding probably not the best way to market it, considering the limitations of the network.
Right. And, you know, also, like, talk to grandma about blockchain. Like, what, she's not going to understand it. But talk to grandma and say there's this digital currency that allows you to, you know, send money to anybody without permission from a bank or anything. And she's like, oh, I get that. You know, free speech money. Oh, cool.
No, and it's, I can't, like, this is another thing I repeat a lot. Like, the gravity of this innovation has not been grasped by
not at all
by most people. No. Like, it is like new forms of money don't come around.
No, not,
like every
it's
few
not
millennia
something that happens every day. Yeah,
yeah.
But I think you know, I look to PayPal, right? And there was a time where people were so hesitant to use their credit card, use their debit card on the internet, put their bank info on the internet. They just would not do it. And PayPal was over to, you know, break through that ceiling. And they were able to do it through email, right? Like, that was the first iteration. And then eBay, you know, partnering with eBay to do payments. And I think if we can bake in Lightning into the browser and empower people to, you know, reward content creators or buy stuff or whatever, and make that experience flawless and seamless and easy, I think adoption can really take off. Like, we have an opportunity to introduce Bitcoin to a million people from around the world, in our case, in a way that these big tech companies couldn't do. Like, Twitter can't just, like, turn on Bitcoin tomorrow for 300 million people. It's just, it's not going to work. They have a lot of problems. But because we're still smaller, we can experiment with stuff like this and introduce people to new products a lot faster.
So when you say Bitcoin native in the browser, what do you mean by that? What kind of functionality are you talking? Like, node extensions, wallets in the browser?
No, that stuff, you know, it's probably going to have to be a desktop app, but that communicates with the browser. So it's running in the background. You install it one time. If we can get people to install a browser, which, by the way, is happening at a faster rate than I even anticipated, actually, and we're still in, like, alpha testing here. We haven't even had a general release. I just put out a couple of tweets and a couple of gabs, and, you know, we have tens of thousands of people installing this browser. But if we can get them to install the browser, I think we can get them to install a wallet, something like a Zap, and then, you know, have that wallet communicate with the browser, and our extension overlays, like the Dissenter extension right now overlays on Twitter, on YouTube, et cetera. So you can, like, dissent individual tweets, dissent individual YouTube links. There's a button. We can actually put a button over the entire internet. And I think that we can do that with payments as well, where we can put, you know, send this person money through Zap, through the back to their Gab account, and just attach a Gab wallet to every Gab account and go from there.
I love this. This is what I've been waiting for.
It's early. Like, it's, I think it's super, super early, right? And the technology is probably not quite there yet. Let's be honest. But the promise is, and you know, the ability to experiment and to test out different ideas and stuff. I mean, once you get the combination of the access technology, which is the browser, and the payment infrastructure, which is something like a Lightning, and you pair those two together, the opportunity becomes limitless in terms of what you can do. You can do a marketplace, you can do an app store, you can do tipping, you can do a Patreon style subscription service. I mean, it's limitless. So I think that's what's really exciting. And that's kind of the next step for the browser is figuring out how that works and what it looks like, and what the first iteration of that is going to be.
It's crazy how creative you can get with it. So for the website that we launched last week, tftc.io, go check it out. We have a page called the Dime Bag where we're experimenting with little 10-cent microtransactions. So the first tool we made was a final thought generator. Random. I have a final thought in every newsletter. We wrote a scraper to scrape the final thoughts, and you pay 10
randomize
cents.
It.
Randomizes it, has a link to the article, just a fun way to interact right. with content. But this was impossible before Bitcoin.
Right, exactly.
And
no, it's, the other thing, too, I think that shitcoin companies should be aware of is, especially if they're open source, is you can do exactly what we did. Like, if you have anything interesting about what you're doing, like, say, a browser that blocks ads and trackers and happens to have a shitcoin in it, somebody can come along and fork it and integrate Bitcoin, and now your shitcoin is useless, right? Like, any project that is doing something like anything interesting is susceptible to this.
So it seems like you're a monetary maximalist, a Bitcoin realist. How did you not get swept up in the shitcoinery?
So we can do my Bitcoin origin story now, right?
Let's do it. Yeah. What's your tale?
Sure. So I got into Bitcoin in 2012, 2013. And I was actually originally mining. I had a
boss.
I had about 45 rigs in the basement with one of my buddies, and we didn't have to pay a heating bill that winter. We actually had fans going. I mean, you know, you live in Pennsylvania; it gets pretty cold during the winters, but we actually had to have fans running to keep the basement cooled down. It was hilarious. But it was a good time. It was a good learning experience, and it got me exposed to the fundamentals of Bitcoin, like understanding mining and how it works and what is this thing, like what is going on here. And then I wrote, actually there's an article in CoinDesk from 2013 from me. There was a subway in Allentown, which was about, you know, an hour from me, that was accepting Bitcoin, and it was one of the first, like,
I remember this article.
Remember this? Yes.
Yeah.
It was one of the first real world businesses that I was aware of that was, especially that was like a major chain that was accepting Bitcoin. So I was like, I have to go there just to, like, say I bought a Subway sandwich for in Bitcoin. And I recorded the experience, and I wrote about
this.
It and stuff. And
yeah.
I think that that sub is now worth like a couple $1,000s, but it was worth it because, you know, you have to, if we're not going to use it, if everybody's going to hodl and not use it to transact, then it's not going to go anywhere. Like, people actually have to use it. Not everybody can just sit on it and hope it goes up. The transaction volume is important, and the actual real world use case outside of, you know, a store or a transfer of money, of large transfer of money, is important. So I don't regret doing that. But that was my intro. And then I never really got into shitcoins at all, to be honest. You know, none of it was really interesting to me. A lot of it is vaporware. You know, we see just words on paper and nobody actually building anything. We see, you know, Ethereum, which is allegedly, you know, the global supercomputer that can't handle 25,000 users on CryptoKitties without congesting the network. And it's just like, if we were to integrate Ethereum into Gab, we would probably explode the network instantly. So it's like, you know, like, build something that actually works and that has an interesting use case. I think smart contracts for like legal IP and stuff potentially have an interesting use case in the future. I think it's still a little bit too early, but nothing compares to the glorious Bitcoin.
Do you think there's a world in which Bitcoin can ever be usurped?
What, the flippening? No, I just because there's too many people that are too invested in it now. The community is growing every day, and it's not just, you know, normal plebs like you and I. It's billionaires that are involved now, and they don't let stuff happen to their money. So I think that's actually a good thing. It's kind of like a defense mechanism for Bitcoin. And I don't see what could possibly do it. Like, I don't, you know, the greatest thing Satoshi ever did too was stay anonymous. Because, you know, we're seeing these forks now where these cult of personalities are, you know, the centralized figurehead of these forks. And, Bitcoin doesn't have that problem, right? There's no centralized person that you can point to. Like, for example, when, there was that rumor that Vitalik had passed away. And it just tanked, right? Ethereum just tanked. Why? Mm-hmm. Like, that's very telling. You don't have that problem with Satoshi. You don't have that problem with the centralized figurehead, where if he said something stupid or did something stupid or died, for example, God forbid, it fucks everything up. So I think I don't think we're going to see a flippening anytime soon.
Neither do I. Yeah, I'm a believer that this is going to be winner take most. Bitcoin's Lindy effect has gotten it to a certain point, and we're almost at a point. Hopefully, if we get Schnorr and Taproot and that stuff implemented to the protocol level, where we're done replacing parts and we're more tightening screws.
Right.
And like you said, I've been saying more recently that the decade mile marker is like huge psychologically for these big billionaires time. And companies mm-hmm. coming into the fray. And
it's just from a marketing standpoint too. Like, you know, I can go to my grandma and be like, "Hey, Bitcoin." She's like, "Oh yeah, I know what that is. You know, I saw that on CBS or whatever." Well, she actually heard about it from me back in 2013, so she's been listening to me pitch Bitcoin to her for 5 or 6 years now. But you know, you go to grandma and you say, "Hey, Tron." She's like, "What?"
Like, movie?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Any normal person? Oh yeah, I saw that movie. You know, like, it's like, you know, or Ripple. What? What are you like? What are you talking about? So that psychological barrier of the 10-year mark is big. I agree. The marketing aspect of it too. It's like everybody knows what Bitcoin is now. It's just getting them to easily be able to buy it and actually use it. That's the hurdle that we have right now. And I think the rebranding part will help too. Free speech money. You want to be able to support your creator that you like on the internet, who is banned from PayPal, who is banned from Chase Bank, who is banned from all these other payment processors. Well, then you're going to have to get Bitcoin. And in our case, that's what we told our community. It's like, listen, we're banned from all these payment processors. If you want to support us, and you do, you're going to have to learn about Bitcoin, and you're going to have to get some, and you're going to have to, you know, here's how you send it to us. And we introduced a lot of our community members to Bitcoin for the first time, which I'm really proud of.
No, that was, I got that email. It was an incredible email that you guys sent out. And, no, it's thank you for all you've done to help Bitcoin adoption as a Bitcoiner myself. And going back to like the messaging, I think Bitcoiners are very good at memeing too. So digital gold, I think that's better than sound money. Free speech money is obviously great. Mm-hmm. We're starting stacking sats here at Tales from the Crypt. And it seems like Bitcoiners are big memers. And that's sort of the world we live in is meme is the new propaganda and the new way to bring something into existence.
Sure, sure.
And so that's the presidency. It's Donald Trump is a meme president.
Absolutely.
People are trying to meme Andrew Yang into the White House. They're trying to secure the bag.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He's in the city now. He's speaking at Consensus, I heard.
Yeah. He's sitting down with Niraj.
Interesting.
And but this is, again, this goes back to the free speech. Memes are starting to be like the NPC meme.
Instagram is fact-checking memes now.
What do you mean?
They announced that they are going to be fact-checking memes.
What does that even mean? How do you do that?
I assume that they're going to do it like YouTube is doing it, where YouTube is fact-checking videos now too. Where if it's a video about a historical event, they will link to the Wikipedia page underneath the video, and there's no way for the creator to remove that. So I assume that if a meme is on Instagram, they're going to detect, probably through machine learning, AI, it's talking about this subject, linked to this information about this subject, which is scary because Wikipedia is so bad that even far left academics tell their students not to cite it, not to use it. You look at our Wikipedia page, for example, and it is literally camped on by communists. Like, and that's just not me calling them communists. Like, it's in their profile. It says they're Antifa, they're a communist. Like, they sit on there all day long. And we have an admin, we have a former Wikimedia employee, and we have like two or three communists who call, again, self-identified communists, who sit on the profile and just smear it with just whatever, you know, they want, citing, you know, the New York Times said this, which is an opinion, this is the reality about Gab. And, you know, I will even, there are people that go in and like try to edit it and say, well, this is what Gab said, like they published this information here, and they say, oh, that's a direct source, we can't use that. So it's like you can't use a direct source from the company itself at, like, for example, information that we filed with the SEC, which it's the real deal. You're not going to take this information. You're just going to take the opinion of this random New York Times writer as the reality and smear the page. So if they're going to do that with every topic now on Instagram, on YouTube videos, et cetera, it's just propagandizing. You know, it's dangerous. Fact-checking memes. What a time to be alive.
How would you even fact check a meme? Memes are just like a picture.
I don't know.
In most parts, like most instances.
It blows my mind. I don't know.
Well, it's scary. Again, it's scary. This conversation scaring the shit out of me. And like, what? At what point do people, like you said, like people are starting, there's more populist movements here in the U.S. and stuff. But like, what is the tipping point, do you think? Like, where people just throw their hands up, like, hey, this is not
enough.
Fucking working.
Yeah, enough. Yeah. I think we're slowly getting there. And, you know, I think people take for granted, like, it's not just, you know, popular influencers who are getting banned and stuff. It's like, you know, I go down my corner bar and I hear people talking about, oh, I was thrown in Facebook jail again. It's like normal people. And they're going to get sick of it. You know, people, especially adult human beings, don't like being treated like children. And when you tell them not to do something, they're going to want to do it more. And they're going to start seeking out alternatives. I think we're going to inevitably see the balkanization of the internet, where, you know, one side of the internet is this corporate, you know, safe space. And the other is, you know, the free and open web that we've always known and loved. And I am intent on leading that side of things for as long as I can. Because, again, I don't want to grow up in a world where there's two or three companies deciding what we can talk about and what is news and who I'm allowed to interact with on the internet.
Yeah. So what is a world in where we succeed look like, in which we succeed?
Oh, well, I think, you know, Bitcoin adoption is crucial to that. I think open source is going to be crucial to that. And I don't know, like, I don't think Facebook's ever going to just outright shut down. But I think that, you know, the best thing that we can do as normal individuals is just opt out of this matrix. And I think the browser for us is a big part of that, is like, stop using these browsers that are owned and controlled by these companies like Google Chrome, you know, even Firefox. They claim to be fighting for liberty and stuff while banning us off their add-on store and et cetera. But, you know, I think getting people to kind of opt out of the matrix, you know, like take the red pill, opt out of the matrix and use products that are built by people who share your values. And the browser, again, is a big part of that for us, because it's you're no longer using and being tracked by these companies. Number one, you're cutting off their ability to make money off of your data. Number two, and your experience is going to be faster and stuff. It's just a benefit. And hopefully we get you introduced to free speech money, and then you don't have to be reliant on PayPal or a bank or anybody to be able to reward people that you care about and, you know, talk about what you want to talk about without, you know, worrying about having a decade's worth of content and network effects that you've built up be shut down overnight. So that's kind of the world that I think that we're going towards.
No, we can't get there quick enough, in my opinion.
And it's going to take time, though.
Right?
It's going to take 5 or 10 years. But I don't – that see, that's the thing, too, is I think people look at Gab and they're like, oh, they only have 1 million members, whatever. You know, there's this misnomer in tech where if you don't have, you know, hundreds of millions of users in a year or two, you're a failure. I'm building for the long term. You look at somebody like Matt Drudge, for example, who – is one of the most traffic websites on the internet, is one of the biggest referrers of traffic on the internet. And he built that up, and it hasn't changed in like 20 years. It's a simple, you know.
Great aesthetic.
Right, yeah. Great 90s aesthetic. But he built that up over 20 years, right? It didn't happen overnight, but now he's, you know, it's one of the biggest websites in the world. And I look at Gab as the same model. You know, we're building for the long game here. This censorship stuff is only going to get worse. It's accelerating now, and it's accelerating at a pace that I didn't predict. Like, I knew it was going to get bad, but I didn't know it was going to get this bad this fast. And, you know, obviously that's good for our business, but, it's not good for humanity. It's not good for, the free flow of information on the internet and for civil liberties on the internet. But again, I'm doing something about it, and I hope to inspire other people to do something about it as well.
I think you are. I think I can be confident in saying that. I think you are inspiring other people. And no, I'm on a similar path. Like, write the newsletter once a day, slowly but surely. I don't have millions of users. I don't consider myself a failure at all. I like writing, building like an audience slowly but surely. Like, shifting back to like the landscape of politics in America today, like, that's why I'm into Bitcoin, is because I think people have been given this false framing where it's like red versus blue. and they're right. pitted against each other. And I believe wholeheartedly that it's a money problem. It's the money, yeah. and the creation of money, the access to the spigot of money creation,
yep.
proximity to the access of the spigot, is sort of what's driving this inequality and this strife in our country more so than any Republican or Democratic policies.
Sure, sure.
And it's helping people realize that. And again, like South Park said it best, you're voting between a turd sandwich and a douchebag that really right. aren't saying anything. Meet right. the new boss, same as the old boss, no right. matter what party it is.
Yep. And
that's the mission I'm on. This isn't a question or anything. It's a statement. Let's try to wake people up. Like, the framing is off. You guys are fighting over something that really isn't the crux of the problem.
Right.
Let's start learning about Bitcoin.
Right. Exactly. I think the other interesting thing too, to me, is you go back to like 2011 with the Occupy Wall Street movement on the left, you know, fighting against the corporations and the 1%. And, you know, then you have the Tea Party on the right fighting against big government and let's make government smaller. And now you fast forward to 2019 and we see the left lobbying corporations to use their power to silence political opponents. And we see the right whining to government to do something about it. So it's just like this whole world has turned upside down on both the left and the right. And I don't think either of those things is the solution. And again, it's you know, you see people on the right that are, you know, begging government to do something. Well, what both sides of the aisle in Congress are owned by big tech. You know how many lobbying dollars are given to both sides? So it's all a dog and pony show. The government's not going to save us. The corporations are not going to save us. The only one that's going to save us is ourselves. And it's individuals like myself and like others who are building real world solutions to these problems that we're facing and that are going to get worse. You know, picking yourself up by your bootstraps, so to say, and taking the problem on head on. And, you know, you're not going to not have adversity, right? Like, we have been no platform from app stores, from payment processors, from hosting providers, you name it. But ultimately it has made us more anti-fragile.
I've got a list of every platform that you've been banned from.
Oh, there's a lot.
So payment bans: Stripe, PayPal, Square, BitPay, Coinbase, hosting, Joyent, Azure, Backblaze, Register, Asia Registry, GoDaddy, App Stores, Apple App Store, Google Play, Mozilla, Google Chrome extensions, Shopify, third-party tools, Embedly, Help Scout, Pusher, crowdfunding websites, Start Engine LA, Start Engine,
Start Engine, yeah.
And Patreon. And then you can't do Twitter ads either.
Yes. There's a lot. That's everything that we've been banned from. And there's probably more that I'm not thinking of there. But every single one of those, when they happened, forced us to think outside the box and forced us to innovate and find a solution. So they think that they, aha, I got them now. Gab can't possibly get back online. We were offline for 6 days. You know, our hosting provider gave us, I think it was 24 or 48 hours to find a new provider. And you talk to any developer about trying to transfer everything to a new hosting provider in 48 hours and they'll laugh at you. It's like, so thank God we had one of our guys who was just up around the clock 16-hour days for like a week straight and got us back online on a new hosting provider. It was really a miracle.
Seems like these are coordinated efforts.
Yes, big time. Yeah, that's
How are they able to coordinate?
Well, who's going to stop them, right? I mean, who's going to stop them? They all, again, are in the same place. They share the same values, the same political beliefs, etc. So they're different companies on paper, yes, but they really are a unified oligarchy in reality. And that's why I kind of laugh at people who are like, well, follow me on Instagram in case I get banned from Twitter. And it's like, ugh, like, are you that naive? Come on. And now we're starting to see Instagram actually was kind of a safe haven for a little bit where they really weren't doing the bans that like Facebook and Twitter were. And now they're starting to crack down even more. We're starting to see, like, we just saw Milo, Alex Jones, all those people get banned because their networks were growing over there too. So,
and a fell swoop too.
Big fell swoop just out of nowhere. Yep. Not surprising. Again, it's going to continue happening. So
it's bold.
It's very bold. And again, where are the consequences? There's no consequences. Why would they stop? Who's doing anything about it? You know.
Well, again, going back to like the entropy of freedom, like you have to, and fighting for it. Like I've been saying too, like TSA airports, they are testing grounds to see how much shit people will put up with. And
exactly.
It seems like it's seeping into the digital world now. Like, oh,
more and more.
You guys are okay with these people just disappearing?
Mm-hmm. Goodbye.
We're going to turn it up. And it's, again, frogs boiling in water. Mm-hmm. How do we wake the people the fuck up? Like,
It may take a bigger ban. Might be a catalyst. But I think it's starting to compound now. You know, at first it was just, oh, it's just the Nazis on the far right, right? The quote unquote Nazis. But now it's, you know, Paul Joseph Watson is a classical liberal. And, you know, you look at his Instagram page and it was like selfies of him and his girlfriend. Like he didn't post anything political there and he got banned. So it's like people are starting to wake up. You know, James Woods, you know, a lot of people know him as, you know, a famous actor or whatever. So it's like the normalization of even people that you would deem quote unquote untouchable, celebrities, whatever, and they're getting banned. You know, it's starting to wake a lot of people up. And I think hopefully people will reach a point where it's just enough and they're going to just check out and seek out alternatives or I think they're going to check out of social media in general. I think we're going to see a large portion of the population that is just like, I don't want to be on any social networks. And that's fine. But there will be others who will seek out like-minded communities. The Balkanization, as I said. And our community is going to be the community that believes in freedom of expression and individual liberty and privacy.
Yeah, well, it's a shame to see them doing this because, again, like the access to information on Twitter in particular. Like Twitter has been my favorite tool over the last decade, especially as a Bitcoiner because you get access to like some of the best
instant
ideas.
Information.
Instant information. Mm-hmm. And why would you try to throttle something that's so fucking beautiful and useful at the end of the day? And it's a net positive for humanity. Like
it is, yeah.
This hate speech and stuff like that. And that's the other thing. The media fucking highlights these things and it's really a micro, it's not even,
they endorse it.
They endorse, it's not even, it's a microcosm. It's a little, again, all about framing. You take a video of 20 neo-Nazis walking down the street and neo-Nazis are taking over America.
Right, exactly. You
know, they're not representative of most people.
Yeah, a not great even, majority of most people. Yes. Yeah, like 99.9% of most people, right? But, you know, the reason that they're endorsing it is because, you know, people like Tim Pool, independent journalists, are.
Shout out Tim.
Shout out to Tim Pool, are a threat to their careers and to their power. So, yeah, of course, they're going to try to smear him, and which they have, and try to no-platform him, which they've tried to do, and attack him and whatever. And it's just a threat to their power. It's a threat to their careers and their control over the narrative. So,
yeah. And actually, talking about people waking up, I think the podcasting world is a little leading indicator that like podcasting in general, this is obviously a podcast, but I started it out of a want to share information I did not think was being shared or
right.
accessed by people. And in Bitcoin in particular, like, the number of Bitcoin podcasts that are popping up is like,
there's a lot.
There's a lot. Like even in other areas, it's individuals realizing like, hey, I can be the news now.
Yes. Exactly.
If I have good information and people want to come to it. Like I can, right. I don't need Wolf
you do it
Blitzer.
From your kitchen table.
Yeah, we can do it in a hotel room.
Yep, exactly. Right? I think Mark Dice, I think he literally works from like his kitchen table every day. And, you know, he's got millions and millions of followers and fans and viewers. And, you know, the other thing is like, we're not owned by anybody. You know what I mean? Like in our case, we're owned by our users. You know, we did 2 crowdfunding rounds where we sold equity to our users and they're our shareholders. So we answer to them. And that is a net benefit because it holds our feet to the fire to stick by our principles. You know, a lot of people are owned. A lot of famous voices are owned, and people don't know that. So when they're all pushing the same agenda or the same narrative, there's a reason for that. You know, there's shadow money behind them that are pushing that agenda.
How about the Easter worshippers thing? Like how weird was that? That they were like all tweeted at the same time. Like there has to be somebody at the top. Like, all right, this is what we're talking about today.
Yeah, I guarantee they have like their, you know, we see these like Bitcoin Slack groups and stuff. They probably have their own internal comms where they all, you know, all their comms people are all in one place. And like, okay, what's the agenda today? Well, what's our unified response on this? And Easter worshipers, as a Christian, that was highly offensive.
It was highly offensive.
That's the other thing that I have a problem with, too, right? If they want to have these hate speech policies, enforce them equally, right? So that means, you know, banning people who are being hateful towards Christians, banning people who are being hateful towards men, banning people who are hateful towards white people. And they're not doing that. You know, there are certain groups and certain protected categories, quote unquote, that, you know, they will punish you for saying anything, even criticism. And others that it's free game. You know, you can threaten to kill white people and get away with it and not get banned, and you know, say Christians are scum or be hateful about them and have no consequences. So if they're going to have these rules, enforce them equally, right?
You can say the white people should be genocided and get hired by the New York Times.
I was just going to say, you're going to get hired by the New York Times, right? Absolutely insane. And not banned, and then verified on Twitter too. It's like, What a world.
Right? And how, going back to the Easter worship thing, like, how fucking sound deaf, how tone deaf are these people that to think, like, you could all tweet this out at once and be like, people are
no one's
going to
pick up
it.
On this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No one's going to notice that everybody's saying the same thing.
That's what gives me confidence that we have a good chance of being successful in our endeavors, because mm-hmm. these people are so, again, tone deaf and out of touch with reality.
They are, yeah. And people are waking up. Like, people are smart. They're picking up on these patterns and they're saying, like, what? Like, are you, like, you know what I mean? It's like, what, are you kidding me? Easter worshipers? Like, what does that even mean? Do I worship the Easter bunny or something? Like, come on. Let's be real here. So I think, you know, I'm optimistic about it. I think a lot of people want to preach doom and gloom and be negative and, oh, the world is burning. And I'm optimistic because I know that there are other people out there like me who are building, in particular in the Bitcoin community and in the open source community. So I'm optimistic about the future, and I think that there will be others who also rise up and build, and hopefully I can influence them to do so.
I am too. I feel like, I mean, the Great Awakening has been talked about a lot, but we're in the beginning of a renaissance of human potential, the likes of which mm-hmm. has never been seen. And,
oh, yeah.
And again, like, the empowerment, people are becoming empowered. Like, holy shit, I can start my own podcast. Mm-hmm. I can hold my own private keys. I can use Dissenter.
Right.
Like, it's...
There's a lot.
And it's exciting, right? It's, and that's what makes me overall optimistic is, all right, these tools exist now. And there's no shutting Pandora's box.
Right.
It's just getting to work. And...
you got to put in the work. That's the thing. Most people don't want to open up the terminal and write hello world, right?
No.
Getting that far is a big step past what most people will do. And again, you know, even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we didn't have a lot of the open source technology that exists today. A lot of the tools that exist today, where your most upfront cost is actually like incorporating for $150 in a state to, you know, start an LLC. You do that and, you know, you plug in all this open source technology and all these APIs, and you can have a new product, you know, in a month if you put in the work. So I hope that other people will start doing that. And I hope that we could, you know, kind of serve as the canary in the coal mine and hopefully one day provide infrastructure for others to build as well. Like, we want to build our own extension store for the browser and have developers be able to build their own apps for that. Stuff like that, that we can provide distribution, we can provide infrastructure for others who share our values and want to preserve liberty and individualism and freedom of expression on the internet, to be able to build alternatives to everything, because that's where it's looking like we're going. We see, you know, this week Microsoft Word puts out they're going to start, I think, editing recommendations for politically correct, like, recommendations for word changes and stuff like that.
What?
Yeah. So it's like, you know, they're even politicizing Microsoft Word now, which is like, how far are we going to go here? You know, like people are tweeting me. They're like, when are you building a free speech Microsoft Word? And I'm like, guys, come on. Like, I was like, how? Like, I can't do it all. You know, like, I can't build it all. I mean, if I have to, I will. But it started out, like I said, as just a social network. And now it's like, well, nope. You need hosting. You need infrastructure. You need payments. You need a browser. You need all. And thankfully, again, it's making us stronger. And hopefully we can offer these tools and these distribution channels to other people who want to build and inspire them to build.
Yeah. And so building it takes a lot of guts, right? As somebody, yeah. I was in Bitcoin world, I was a lurker for many years, mm-hmm. just in the background on Twitter, a few hundred followers, never really speaking up. And it took me a while to, like, develop the confidence. I actually had to have, like, a big life event, traumatizing life event happen, like light a fire into my ass, be like, mm-hmm. all right, I'm going to start fucking building.
Yeah, you get one life, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You got to live it vicariously.
So what would you recommend to somebody who's maybe like lurking or thinking about building, but doesn't have the confidence? And
right.
How would you?
It takes courage. It really does. It's not easy, and it won't be easy, but it's so rewarding, and I wouldn't change a thing. I love what I do every day. I love our community. I love fighting for something and building something that I believe in, and that I believe is essential for humanity and for freedom, and for progress. You know, the thing that I would say is, if you don't do it, and if everybody cowers in fear, nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to get done. So, you know, it takes somebody to step up and push that first domino, which hopefully I've done. to be a mover, to push that first domino over and inspire the other dominoes to fall in line and come out and say, I'm not afraid. And stand your ground too. This thing with, apologizing for tweets that are 10 years old. You know, we see sports people that are, you know, when they were 14 years old, they tweeted out a thing. And I think that, you know, there's stuff that we say in the moment. Maybe I was having a bad day. I'm not the same person that I was 10 years ago. I don't think any of us are. And this lynch mob of going after people for old tweets or whatever is absurd to me. It's, you shouldn't be afraid to fail. You shouldn't be afraid to say something that, you might, look back on and say, what was I thinking? You know, because then you'll never say anything, you know, you just, and we start to see this on Twitter now and stuff where people are self-censoring. They're afraid to say certain things because they don't want to get banned.
You shouldn't be telling people to learn the code, all right?
Yeah, that was absurd. And, that was it's journalist privilege there.
We lost a couple Bitcoiners to that learn the code hashtag. Michael Goldstein. I always mess up his last name. Had the perfect learn to code tweet.
I saw that. I think I retweeted that.
Yeah. When some journalist was like, we need to block all these people with the hashtag learn to code. It's like, if you know how to use Twitter's API and you learn to code.
Yeah, if you learn to code, you can do this, right? Yeah, shout out Bitcoin Carnivores, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I eat a lot of steak.
Same.
I'm an omnivore.
Same. I eat a lot of steak.
Yeah.
I went full carnivore for a while. I might go back.
It's hard. It's hard in this city in particular.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's so much good food around you, man.
Ugh. There's so much good food. Yeah. It's so much convenient food. Like,
yes.
I work at home. I work from my desk at home, and there's a Shake Shack down the street. And, like, sometimes I'm just like, all right, Marty.
See, I'm Italian, so I love the pasta.
Oh.
Yeah.
I've been trying to I like a chicken parm every once.
Chicken parm's good.
Every once in a while, some good pasta.
This is now a food podcast, folks.
Oh. No, again, like, back to big. Like, that's one thing that drives. Like, there's finally, again, before Bitcoin and before a lot of these open source technologies that are proliferating, I feel like reality, humanity has been detached from reality. And mm-hmm. from an economics perspective, like, the CPI doesn't make sense. The Fed has no idea what they're doing. A lot of things that are reported really have no connection to reality.
Sure.
And in the media as well, CNN, based fake news.
Mm-hmm.
Framing narratives and stuff right. like that to their advantage. Now we have Twitter and Bitcoin's provided a common mission that I feel like has not existed on this planet in a while.
Yeah, it's unifying. And I think that's why we see a lot of overlap with the Bitcoin community into what we're doing, because most Bitcoiners tend to be you know, people that believe in individual liberty, believe in freedom of expression. You know, code is free speech too. That's the other thing that we should be worried about is if they're going to start censoring speech and creating new rules around speech and attacking the First Amendment, they're inevitably going to attack code.
Hate code's coming, freaks.
Hate code. Well, that's actually, I mean, that's a narrative that's being pushed now. I mean, you see the drama in the Linux community with the SJWs going after
the slave.
Yeah, trying to change the terminology and stuff. Just absolutely insane. Like, why does everything have to be politicized?
They made Linus apologize.
Yeah, yeah, and that's,
he bent the knee, man.
If there is one thing that anybody can get from this podcast, stop apologizing. It's weakness.
Why do you say this?
It does not get you anywhere. It doesn't get you. You don't get points with the left for, you know, bending your knee to their demands and then apologizing for it. You have to stand strong and say, yeah, I said it. Maybe I don't agree with it now, but I don't apologize for it. And I'd say it again, right? Like, just like, F you, I don't care. We got to have this alpha attitude of just not caring about what the mob says, and not bending to it, because a lot of it is fake too. Like, there's a lot of botnets that when people are in the outrage mob, the botnets will pick up on it and they'll go after that target just to make it look like, oh, there's a lot of people that are really mad about this, so I better go and apologize. And it's like, it's fake. So much of it is a house of cards. It's not reality. You know, I think that's the other thing we take for granted is people think that, like, every American is on Twitter. Well, reality is that there's only about 30 million alleged active accounts in the U.S. And of those, I would say probably a nice chunk are bots, meaning they have U.S. IPs, but they're automatically tweeting. They have, like, they signed up for a horoscope app back in 2013, and it's been tweeting their horoscope every day ever since, and that's an active U.S. user, right? So reality, probably, you know, 15, 20 million tops. So, like, that's not all of America. It's a very small subset of America. And it's not what all of Americans believe. So seeing it on Twitter is not an active reflection of what reality is.
Trump's presidency proved that. I mean, you had this whole coalition of three pillars of the four pillar system basically saying that Hillary's going to win, and middle America.
That's why they were so caught off guard.
Middle America was like, nah.
Well, exactly. Well, like, they were so caught off guard because everything that you would see on Twitter every day and on Facebook every day was like, Hillary's going to win, and on TV every day and every medium. But that's not an accurate reflection of what the populace was thinking, clearly.
Well, if most of the population isn't on these social networks, how did Russia infiltrate?
Yeah, right. 200 accounts and $100,000 in Facebook ads. I used to work in advertising. I was an ad tech for about 5 years in my last company. I will tell you, $100,000 in Facebook ads did not sway this election. I will tell you that right now. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to break it to you, but that did not. And 200 sock accounts from the Russians on Twitter did not influence the election. I'm sorry. I hate to break it to you, but
no, it goes back to, like, personal responsibility, extreme ownership. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to allocate blame to something. Mm-hmm. That they perceive as a boogeyman, but it's like, take some fucking personal responsibility. Like, take a look inside.
Right.
Get your house in order and figure out why people are voting this way. Don't just try to blame
a clean your room, botnet. As Jordan Peterson would say.
Yeah. Right?
Clean your room. I think people want to look to the state. They want to look to the corporations, which in a sense are now more powerful than a lot of states. I mean, you look at Facebook and it is worth more. It has more information than any state on earth, and probably has more power than a lot of countries on earth. And we have to ask ourselves if that's a world we want to live in, where corporations are, dictating what civil liberties we're allowed to have on the internet. And in my case, that's not a world that I want to live in. So that's why I'm building on the world that I want to see, which is individual liberty, freedom of expression, open source, user choice, free association. I talk a lot about freedom of speech, but I think freedom of association, when we started earlier, is often overlooked.
Why do you think this?
I don't know. I think this concept of looking to Big Brother to save the day, whether Big Brother is the corporation or the government, has kind of, and this collectivist thinking, this groupthink, has really just eliminated the whole concept of free association from people's minds, because free association goes hand in hand with individualism and individual liberty and taking control of your own life and your own experience. So I think when you eliminate the individualism, it eliminates the, oh wait, I don't have to follow this person, and I can take control and block them and mute this word or unfollow them, or hey, put my phone down for 5 minutes, So I don't know. I think that's all. They all are kind of interconnected. So I think that's part of a symptom of the larger, broader issues.
Mm-hmm. If you were to give advice to an individual out there to sort of develop a framework through which to critically think based off your history of studying philosophy, like, how would you sort of, 'cause that's one thing. We both went to Jesuit schools. The mm-hmm. Jesuits. I went to a Jesuit high school, and they were very keen on teaching us to think critically and why messages were being framed a certain way. And
right.
Interested to hear what you believe or what you think on this subject.
Yeah. Know what you don't know. You know, Socrates says, know thyself. Or at least we think he did because he never wrote anything down. We only know what we know from him from through Plato. Know yourself enough to know what you don't know. And, you know, seek out and surround yourself with people who are experts on those things. So I'm not an engineer, for example. You know, I've dabbled in coding and stuff, but I frankly don't have the patience for it, right? And it's not something that I would be very good at. And I recognize that. So I surrounded myself with people who do know how to code and are very good at it. And, you know, there's other things that I don't know a lot about and that I seek out people who are experts in those things to learn. So you have to know what you don't know, and you have to know yourself enough to know what you don't know. So that's, I guess that would be my advice.
Yeah, no, it's great advice. And again, bringing it back to Bitcoin, Bitcoin sort of highlights this because it's so multifaceted, you know, computer science, economics, mm-hmm. monetary yeah. history. And that's the beauty of the Bitcoin quote unquote community. A community of people that like to talk about Bitcoin. Is that each brings their own knowledge base. Mm-hmm. I studied economics. Like I can't code either. I don't have the patience for it either. I love going to talk to developers that are working at the protocol level to get their view of how things are going. Mm-hmm. And then,
well, it's economics, it's computer science. It's a lot of philosophy. It's a lot of, political science as well. So these things all overlap, and you have experts in different verticals that all have this shared, value system that all are working towards the same goal. That's very powerful. And that's what makes the Bitcoin community so powerful, is like this global network of experts in all these different fields who all see the potential and all see are excited about it in different ways. You have economists that are excited about it for one reason. You have computer scientists that are excited about it for another. You have philosophy guys like me who are excited about it for just the philosophical aspect of it. So I think all those shared passions and those shared values coming together towards a common goal, I don't think we've seen something like that on a global scale in a long time. And that's why it's so exciting for me. Is like, you know, you could be, you know, a kid, a 13-year-old kid in India who is excited about Bitcoin and can code up a project or can contribute to the conversation and add some value. That's exciting to me.
Yeah, there's a 15-year-old out there who's been hacking all the hardware wallets.
Right.
Shamir, I believe his name is. I could be butchering that, but he's a 15-year-old, Anon, I believe, and he's hacked the Trezor Ledger multiple times.
Unbelievable.
And
unbelievable.
He's contributing.
Yep.
And again, like we both said, like this is a common mission that is waking people up. And me personally, I think I've met some of the smartest people I've met in my life just
absolutely.
By being into this stuff.
And mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's rewarding, and it's led me to this conversation today, which has been thoroughly rewarding. It's been a great conversation, man.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for coming by. I don't want to take up too much of your weekend here. You got a magical crypto conference.
I got to run over there, yep.
I'm not going to make that. I am about to interview Jack Mahler later, this interview freaks. Andrew, before we part, do you have a parting note for the freaks out there? Any words of wisdom?
Get on gab.com and buy Bitcoin.
Pretty simple. Yeah. Good advice.
Yep.
Peace and love, freaks.